The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
An example of an operation that was arguably very successful and extremely fast is an example of oral disinformation. So during the Grand Siege of Mecca in 1979, the rumor made the rounds in Pakistan that the Americans were somehow trying to take control of the mosque in Mecca. And the Soviets seized on that rumor. They essentially picked it up in Karachi, I believe, and then replayed it on the radio and fed it to their people on the ground, to the Pakistani public. And famously, there was a mob, or a sort of a large demonstration, that stormed the embassy in Islamabad, and a couple of people died. I think four people died. And it was a deadly outcome of an active measure.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 29th, 2020. Today on the podcast, we're bringing you a conversation between Jack Goldsmith and Thomas Ridd on Ridd's new book, Active Measures: The Secret History of Disinformation and Political Warfare. It's a fascinating book about the history of information operations and influence campaigns, and we're excited to bring you not one but two discussions on it. Tomorrow on the Lawfare Podcast's Arbiters of Truth miniseries on disinformation, Alina Polyakova and I will be sharing our own discussion with Thomas about the book. On today's episode, Jack and Thomas discuss the history of disinformation from the beginning of the 20th century through the 1980s. Tomorrow, Alina, Thomas, and I will discuss Thomas's research, starting at the beginning of the internet age. We hope you'll listen. It's the Lawfare Podcast. Thomas Ridd on Active Measures, Part 1.
I'm very pleased to be here today with Thomas Ridd to talk about his new book, Active Measures, The Secret History of Disinformation and Political Warfare. Thomas, thanks for joining me. I loved your book. I learned so much from it. In every chapter, I learned a lot. And why don't you start off by telling us what the title means and what the book's about?
Well, thank you for the very kind words. That means a lot to me, coming from you, actually. The title, Active Measures, refers to the phrase that the different Soviet bloc intelligence agencies started using in the early 1960s to describe disinformation. They first called it disinformation, then moved to active measures because it was bureaucratically more useful, and also because it captured the essence better. The active measures aren't about seeding and spreading false information, which is a popular misconception. They're about activating a response, an emotional or political response. And whether information is true or false is not the most important aspect here.
But how does that differ from what I think of as a traditional covert operation? And I realize these distinctions might be overlap, but so a covert operation, broadly defined, was an operation designed to have an influence on a foreign political system or a foreign environment where the activity was deniable to the agent doing it. Is there overlap between covert action and this?
You know, covert action, of course, is a Western terminology and active measures is a Soviet terminology. So I think if we take a step back, there is significant overlap. But in a way, active measures is more narrow. It's operations that have no kinetic, if you like, but spreading information. These are influence operations, to use a more modern term, and not so much what we usually understand as covert operations today.
Okay. I'm going to try to unpack the meaning of active measures, and I'm going to invite you to use some of the great examples from the book. And we're going to focus mostly on historical examples, pre-1990, pre-2000s, because there's going to be another podcast talking about more recent developments. So you say that active measures are not spontaneous lies by politicians, but they're more methodological and planned. You associate them with a large bureaucratic organization, and I think primarily foreign intelligence organizations. Why that definition? And can you give an example?
Yeah, so of course I needed to write a book that has, you know, a bracket around it that has limits. And I decided to focus on the way modern intelligence agencies in the 20th century, professional bureaucracies, have developed units and professionalized their tactics and procedures in order to create an effect. The one thing that I would point out here is that's really important for that Soviet origin of the term active measures, as well as the practice that evolved throughout the Cold War. It's really Leninist in origin. It goes back to active measures operators often quoted Lenin to underline the political aspect of this kind of struggle. This was deliberate politicization of intelligence operations, if you like. They were often quoting Lenin with this phrase that it is about driving a wedge into pre-existing cracks in the target society. So a perfect example, I think, for an operation here is the 1960s pamphlet that KGB spread in Africa. And the pamphlet pretended to be from African-American activists in the United States, portraying the real ugly face of American society when it comes to blacks, to African-Americans. And it was a really insidious operation, because most of the stories in it, in fact, almost 100%, were completely accurate, describing lynchings in the South, racial crime, police violence against African-Americans in the South, predominantly. And it was very difficult to counter because it was factual. But of course, the cover story, the alleged source, was a fake organization that did not exist.
So this is one of the remarkable things about active measures to me, is the combination of truthful and untruthful, or truthful information with sources muffled or misleading sources. Why does it matter what the source is? Why in that example, in the example of our dear friend's booklet, why does it matter that it's a Soviet operation? I mean, the same thing could have been done by domestic politicians in those African countries. What analytically is accomplished by calling that an active measure? And I ask this because I'm thinking about, just as a point of reference, I am thinking about the Russian operation in 2016. And there, I mean, would we have looked at that completely differently if it had been done, if the hack of the DNC had been done not by the Soviets, but say by a Bernie Sanders supporter? So I'm just trying to figure out why it's important to understand this, that the source.
Yeah, it's a great, actually really hard question, conceptual, very difficult question. Because if it's true, essentially, that if I'm understanding your question correctly, if something is factually correct, why does the sourcing even matter?
Right, exactly.
So I think there are two answers to this question. The first is from the point of view of a journalist who's writing a story. If somebody gives you sources, gives you a story, and the story checks out 100%, you can verify all the facts, and it's completely accurate. We have examples from the Cold War where that happened, where journalists received files knowing that they came from KGB as a leak, but the leak was completely correct. For example, about nuclear targeting lists, American nuclear targeting lists in Western Europe. Should you publish? And I think the answer, the ethically correct answer to me, is if there is a very high news value and you can be, you know, close to 100% sure that, or even 100% sure that you're writing the right thing, that it's factually correct, then I think you're ethically on the safe side publishing it, even knowing that we have an influence operation. But of course, there's the second aspect is equally important. I mean, you have to turn the influence operation itself, the active measure itself, into the story. You make it part of the story, because it is a crucial aspect of the story that the story came, was, you know, used by an adversarial intelligence agency to achieve a political effect. So I think we can't pretend that the sourcing doesn't matter. And also, for practical reasons, in the vast majority of cases, and that's an empirical statement, there is some level of forgery, not just on the sourcing, but on the actual content side, slipped in.
That's a great example, and it sounds like the right approach to me to how journalists in the West should deal with these things. And that issue seems to be raised a lot with the rise of these secure, anonymized drop-off locations that newspapers have for people to anonymously disclose information. Because then I suppose that newspapers try to confirm the identity of the source, but sometimes they might not be able to. And so it really raises a question whether, given that form of journalism, it's an opportunity for foreign influence operations.
And absolutely. I mean, the drop sites, the secure drop implementations on Tor hidden services, the dark web, for example, of course, this is a new technology, but the whole idea is not new. I mean, you could simply mail leaked secret documents without a return address, that happened a lot in the 1970s, in fact, for some reason, often from Rome. KGB had apparently somebody, a station in Rome, a residentura that liked to use the mail. And that was the exact same dynamic.
So going back to the question I had about covert operations, and you're right, that's a Western, it's even, I'm thinking about it actually in strictly American terms, what that phrase means. But one, to come back to something we talked about a second ago, one sometimes element of these active measures is that they're open. And sometimes even the involvement of the Foreign Intelligence Agency might not be a terrible thing for them. Another element that was remarkable to me was how sometimes they take effect over time, sometimes they come out slowly, and that can be okay.
Yeah, I find this also fascinating. So especially reading about active measures in post-Soviet or in old Soviet archives, especially Stasi, and the Czechs provide a lot of material, the Bulgarian state security archives also. The word contradiction is always used. They have a quite Marxist language in some ways. And active measures are essentially vehicles to exacerbate contradiction, to differentiate, as they called it, existing divisions in the target society, as I mentioned. But that is so fascinating because the contradiction also applies to the active measures itself. And you just pointed out one. They're open, but at the same time covert, meaning almost all of them, not all of them, but almost all of them are designed to have a public effect, but want to remain hidden. And to me, it is fascinating to see that some operations or some projects, to use a CIA term that is, I think, is better here, because some projects lasted for up to a decade and longer and were never discovered in public, although they published hundreds of thousands of media items. So the example that I have in the book, in fact, for the first time in public discussion, is a CIA front in Berlin called Elsie Kassock. Cover name was PR Office Kramer for a while. That really we only know about because it was revealed in CIA archives half a century later. You know, to your point that there is open operations with a covert aspect. Is that where you were driving at there?
Yeah, that's good. But that raises the question of two questions for me. One is, I want to get to the amazing research you did here and the unusual things you found and that you posted and made available publicly. I guess what the first question, though, is how do you, I always wonder this about covert action generally, how do you know what you don't know? You don't know what you don't know. And how, I guess I'm asking, let me put this more clearly. How confident are you that you have captured a representative sample of what active measures are like? Because I assume that there are many active measures campaigns in history that we don't know anything about yet.
Absolutely, yes. This is the hardest question. You know, there were days when I was, especially in the Bulgarian and some Stasi files, but the Bulgarian files are often in Bulgarian notes from meetings with the Service A, the disinformation unit in the first chief directorate of KGB in the 70s and 80s. So I read one of those briefings where the head of, you know, the disinformation for KGB, Ivanov, lays out how the art of active measures works in practice. And he would mention examples every now and then, a book that they did, maybe a book that they did with a consultant. And I would often read these, you know, references, and I'm like, okay, this is a book they did, so I surely can pull it up, probably buy it immediately from Abe Books because nobody else has found it before. And I would do that again and again. And it was just a kind of scary experience to suddenly, you know, read in the archive, Google the title of a book, and boom, there's the Washington Post review of a fake KGB book from the 1970s that, of course, nobody knew was a fake memoir at the time. So how confident am I that I captured the most representative examples? You know, because we have so many primary source files, or not so many, we have enough, also from Soviet archives, I get the impression that I have a rough overview, because there are, for example, yearly plans and yearly evaluations of ongoing operations. But of course, it's also terrifying to understand that many of these operations I have never heard about and haven't actually seen.
So tell us, so among the many amazing things about this book are the archives and sources that you mined. Can you just give us kind of an overview of the greatest hits as you see them? And, you know, much of it that I've seen, I haven't explored at all. You've made available publicly. It's just amazing stuff.
Yeah. So what I did is, I mean, there are a couple of historians that covered aspects here. So a couple of German historians have, for example, spent a lot of time researching the HIV/AIDS myth that this is an American bioweapon. So in the early 1980s, mid 1980s, KGB spread this false notion that AIDS is a bioweapon designed in Fort Detrick. And we now have the memos, the KGB memos, spelling that operation out, and we know the purpose. The purpose was to distract from their own use of chemical weapons in Southeast Asia, especially Afghanistan at the time. So reading these memos, some of them very hard to find and already touched upon in research. But what I often did is I then went into the archives, requested more files, looked at more files, and cross-referenced in multiple languages, especially Bulgarian, German, and Czech. And that material is just absolutely extraordinary, and I'm only really scratching the surface. There are many more PhD dissertations to be done with that KGB material.
And how about on the American side? What was the most interesting stuff you found on the American side?
So on the American side, the CIA archives, just when I started writing the book, CIA put its full CREST archive online. So we're looking at 13 million PDF pages of files, close to a terabyte of information altogether. And the especially interesting is the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act. That is a law that has much more leverage to declassify material out of the CIA archive than normal FOIA would have or normal releases would have. So in the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act disclosures here, we have far more information, fewer redactions. And I sourced three chapters on CIA fronts in Berlin from that archive. CIA has a phenomenally bad search functionality on its website. I don't think on purpose, but it's just bad. And so I spent a lot of time downloading and re-text recognizing the entire CIA archive, all 13 million pages. And that search tool was just an absolutely priceless thing to use in my research.
And tell us where all these, I mean, you've made available a lot of the documents and interviews.
So at some point, I decided, okay, if I'm writing a book about disinformation, I really need to show my work so to make clear that I have as little disinformation as possible in the book. And I decided not just to reference obscure documents that most people would never be able to pull up on their own, or, you know, sometimes involves travel and requests and whatnot. And I put everything that I had electronically that was on the public domain, which applies to most archival material, on the Internet Archive. So the book has, I haven't counted, but something like 80 URLs in the endnotes to the direct sources. So if you like, the book is coming with a 30,000 page annex of additional information. Most of it actually Nazi files that are not really important for the book, but there was this bizarre operation where the KGB passed on 30,000 pages of Nazi intelligence documents to the Czechs for an active measure. And for some reason, I have all these Nazi files and didn't know what to do with them. So I also included them in the links there.
So the first link I went to, what came from the introduction, in the introduction to the book, you refer to an interview you did with Czech intelligence officer named, with a defector named Ladislav Bittman, I think is his name. And yeah. You linked to a 2-hour interview you had with him, which I listened to about a third of, and it was just amazing. Tell us who Bittman is and what role he played in helping you understand these issues.
Yeah, so Bittman was the number 2 in the Czech, in Department 8 of the of STB, his foreign intelligence arm in Czechoslovakia. He defected in 1968 because he was frustrated with the suppression of the Prague Spring at the time. And he wrote a book called The Deception Game. After he defected, he testified in Congress under pseudonym and then under his real name a few times, or 2 times, I think, and became a scholar of disinformation after he was a practitioner of disinformation for many years. And he was just a remarkable mind and individual, because he was so thorough and so well-spoken and deliberate that I had read his 2 books, read his testimonies, and I thought, okay, I want to talk to this man as soon as possible, because he was quite old already at the time. So I stopped on the way to my Senate testimony there in 2017, and I had a long conversation with him, which his partner later allowed me to, after he died, to publish, and that's what I included as the first link there that you found.
And he figures later in the operation at the bottom of the lake. I can't remember the name of Neptune, was it?
That's right.
And just tell us about that episode. I thought that was really interesting.
Well, yeah, Neptune. So basically, Neptune happens 19 years after the end of World War II, after the Holocaust. And the main purpose of the operation, which we now know because I have the case files, they're also in the end notes, 2,800 pages of documents. We know the precise purpose of this operation. And the purpose was to try to get the German Bundestag in Bonn at the time to extend the statute of limitations of war crimes, which was about to expire 20 years after the end of the war. And of course, the Czechoslovaks didn't want the Germans to get away with war crimes, but also wanted to be in a position to blackmail people that they knew had, you know, dark secrets in their past. It's a very powerful recruiting tool. And so they decided to run this operation to dump files in a lake and then find these Nazi treasures in this dark Bohemian lake in the mountains in the forest close to the border to Germany, and make a big brouhaha, a huge press story out of this, and maybe slip a few forgeries into these Nazi files. The story is very long and convoluted. But they ended up not slipping any forgeries in because they didn't have time, and finally made these files that they received from Moscow public in September 1964.
So there are 2 things about the story, at least 2 things that are interesting to me. First, there was credibility lent to this, as I recall, because they actually were finding Nazi troves in some lakes in this part of the world, right?
Yeah, they found a helmet, they found some explosives and a rifle. There were actual Nazis on the lake.
Yeah. And the second thing was, and this brings us back to Bittman, you had a discussion with him about how do you tell whether these operations work? Because as I recall, Germany did extend the statute of limitations. It did leave Nazi war criminals on the hook. But they couldn't really tell if this successful operation, which ended up producing a whole bunch of stories in the West, you couldn't really tell if it contributed or how much of an impact on that. Is that right?
Yes. So the operation created a lot of press coverage. The documents in the lake were widely covered. And STB, and they did this on KGB orders with help from KGB in correspondence with KGB, which we can all see in the archives. They essentially had a very narrow soda straw view on their operation and the press coverage. So what they saw was only the files in the lake, the press coverage as a result, and soon after the German Bundestag extended the statute of limitations. What they didn't see is that this entire process, what they didn't see as clearly as they should have, is that this entire process, Germany coming to terms with its, you know, with World War II and with the Holocaust, was just a gigantic cultural development that was all encompassing. I mean, I am German. I was born and raised in Germany and had many of these conversations in my own family about what did my grandparents do in the war. This is something that in every family, everybody talked about. The idea that a few files from some lake in Bohemia that weren't even that powerful moved the needle there, it's just like, it was more like pouring a bucket of water on a glacier that was already moving. But of course, if you only look at that bucket of water up close, you think you actually moved the glacier. So that dilemma, which ultimately amounts to self-disinformation, is not limited to that case, but I think we see it throughout history.
And Bittman had a nice reflection on the difficulty of measuring the effects of these operations. And I think we're going to play a clip of it here.
You can never measure the degree, how much you influenced this, whether it was 20%, 30%, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You have no reliable measurement device. So usually when the operation succeeded in achieving what was officially proclaimed in the beginning, that it would be the objective, if most of it was achieved, then the final report was, we totally achieved the goal and blah, 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 the Americans were hurt and claiming the whole, that the operation was actually a result. Yeah. Of the victory.
So this raises the question for me. You talk in the book more than once, a few times, I think, about how active measures more than other intelligence operations are a world of pragmatists, not perfectionists. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, so let's just take the lake Operation Neptune as an example to make that point. It was exquisitely planned with detailed memos that spelled out all sorts of ideas and contexts, and because they ultimately needed high-level approval from the Minister of the Interior in this case. And then in the execution, it was full of improvisation. And that, I think, is just a fascinating thing. You have in active measures historically a lot of planning up front and improvisation in the execution. And this results ultimately in better operations, because you need to be able to react to the adversary reacting. And of course, that, if we wanted to take the conversation to the present, is one of the aspects where the internet made that feedback loop faster. It took weeks and months, sometimes even years, to react to the adversary in the Cold War. That, of course, can be done much more quickly today.
We'll get to that in a second. But is the reason that pragmatism prevails here also because the aim is disruption, and disruption can take many forms and take time to develop, and because it seems like you almost have less control by definition over these operations and how they're going to play out?
Absolutely, because a lot of it is public. But one fascinating example of an improvised operation is sometimes basically active measures take advantage of crisis. So you have to act extremely quickly, and there's no time to write memos over weeks and weeks. An example of an operation that was arguably very successful and extremely fast here improvised is an example of oral disinformation. So during the Grand Siege of Mecca in 1979, the rumor made the rounds in Pakistan that the Americans were somehow trying to take control of the mosque in Mecca. And the Soviets seized on that rumor. They essentially picked it up in Karachi, I believe, or Islamabad, I forget, and then replayed it on the radio and fed it to, via their people on the ground, to the Pakistani public. And famously, there was a mob or a sort of a large demonstration that stormed the embassy in Islamabad, and a couple of people died. I think four people died as a result, including a Marine guard. And it was a deadly outcome of an active measure. It was an active measure that was oral. That's how KGB called it internally, oral active measures. And it moved extremely quickly, responding to a crisis.
So tell me if this is a fair characterization of the examples in your book. Most of them, the bulk of them, seem to me to be active measures by the Soviet Union and Russia, and the minority seem to be coming from the West. Is that, first of all, is that accurate?
Yes. In my book, absolutely yes.
And I'm just wondering, is the reason for that, is that an archival thing, or is that just a function of the documents and information you were able to get access to? And let me float a couple of other theories. One theory is, at least according to your book, it was the Russians, or the Soviets, I guess, or it was right around that period of the transition, that were started thinking systematically about disinformation operations. And at least according to your book, the Americans didn't really get into it in a heavy way until after, in a kind of organized way, until after World War II, during and after World War II. And then you tell the story that U.S. intelligence services retreated from the disinformation battlefield in the 1960s, but the Soviet Union didn't. So is this more of a Soviet Union game than it was a U.S. game? Is that one of the lessons here?
To me, in my mind, absolutely yes. So as we all come out of World War II, of course, the Cold War is at its rawest, especially in Berlin. The ideological confrontation is ambitious and pretty extreme. So CIA really takes the gloves off pretty much immediately in 1949-50 and opens these front organizations, a couple of them I'm describing in Berlin, and I'm sure there are more we still don't know about. But what happens is that as CIA and then the Soviets do something comparable and arguably react to some of these CIA operations, as I'm describing in the book, but they escalate in a way that the West, that CIA is unable to pull off at the time. They escalate into anti-Semitic operations, into racially charged operations. They basically have no moral limits. And of course, at some point, it becomes clear that democracies have just self-imposed limitations, that, and those limitations get stronger as, you know, oversight is improving, especially in the context of Watergate, the Church Commission. The controls and the limits for Western intelligence agencies get stronger. And in the East, you have the opposite effect. The escalation increases and they become even more aggressive, driven by a number of forces. But one of them I'll just point out is they become better at exploiting contradictions in their adversary's setup, as cynicism about communism is improved, bizarrely, because it's just, they just become so incredibly professional at just spotting active measures and exploiting them, moving fast, the planning there. You know, it's fascinating. You have these large bureaucracies, intelligence organizations that come from, have a military culture, ultimately. Many of them are essentially with a military mindset and military promotion systems, military ranks, etc., like Stasi, for example, HVA. And at the same time, they manage to internally create this almost counterculture type of individual working in active measures who is immersed in their adversary's subculture, watching very carefully what's happening in gay activist circles, for example, LGBT today, and exploiting and amplifying rumors that emerge in these sort of fringe circles at the time. So what I'm referring to here is the AIDS myth was actually first articulated in far left gay magazines. So it is really extraordinary that they have this internal a type of internal artist, ultimately, who become the most effective disinformation operators. So in my mind, it's not a coincidence that Bittman becomes an artist after he gets out.
But does that mean, so your explanation for why the U.S. had this spurt of coordinated and bureaucratized active measures and then kind of trailed off in the 60s was because at some point there was moral constraints that bound even our intelligence agencies. Is that the basic account for why this didn't survive the 60s, if that's the claim?
That's a great question. I don't have a high confidence answer here. I tried to get to the bottom of this. I couldn't based on the files that I've seen in the archives. But I would point to the Penkovsky papers, which is a CIA book that was published under CIA cover of the Oleg Penkovsky's memoirs, and which is based on his debriefings. But CIA never revealed its hand. And there's this extraordinary situation playing out that another Soviet defector, Peter Deryabin, is making the first cut of the draft. I mean, he's basically producing the first draft of what became the Penkovsky papers, former KGB officer. And Deryabin introduces a few, you know, just stories that he made up that are not in the actual debriefings. And then you can see the back and forth inside CIA. In the SE division about the merits of introducing forgeries here, and they say, no, we don't want to do this. We want, you know, we want an accurate account out there, a book that is truthful and credible. Let's just take the draft away from Deryabin and give it to somebody else who's treating this with more caution. To me, that's just it captures the spirit of the moment that CIA pulls back from this forging at scale, especially if they are actually also hitting an American audience with the product.
So in part that might be because there's this policy and law in the United States, I'm not going to get it exactly right, that CIA operations are not supposed to have redounding effects on free speech inside the United States. Part maybe that rule, which I didn't state correctly, but is sort of true, is maybe reflective of the norm that you're talking about, and maybe is one of the reasons for the difference between the American use of this tool and the Soviet and Russian use of the tool.
I think this question would be a fascinating subject for a specific, you know, research paper in intelligence history. Yeah.
You don't purport to have an answer to this in your book. Let me ask you the flip question. Do you think it's true that democracies, as opposed to more controlled or authoritarian states, are more subject to active measures? In other words, are active measures, all things equal, more successful in democracies than in non-democracies?
Absolutely. I think active measures are the natural instrument tool that an authoritarian, non-democratic system is using against a democratic system. So you have push and a pull driver. The pull, of course, I mean, on the one side, you have democracies that are just more vulnerable because they're open, because they have a free press. We have many quotes from active measures operators about how much they appreciate journalists. The head of Stasi's Department X, the disinformation department, once told his internal recruits, "What would active measures be without the journalist?" he asks rhetorically. And of course, on the other side, as we just talked about, active measures, you can really take the gloves off if you're not a democracy in a way that you just can't when you're a democracy. So, but punchline is, you can't be good at active measures. You can't be good at disinformation and democracy at the same time.
Yeah, so the combined effect of those two trends, that democracies are inclined or naturally limited in using this tool compared to non-democracies, and at the same time, the nature of their society makes them more prey to these measures. That means that, and I guess this is one of the punchlines from your book, true or false, that basically this active measures are a huge asymmetrical advantage that non-democracies have towards democracies in international relations.
Well, at some point as I wrote the book, I had this idea, but I don't think it's complete. It's possibly even a little naive to think that way. And I think the counterpoint is that active measures, and again, our discussion of Neptune just now, and it's the difficulty of measuring effects. Active measures are so hard to measure that they seduce bureaucracies that focus on disinformation at scale into overstating their effect systematically, consistently, and, you know, over a long period of time. Basically, they perform some form of self-deception as a result, to the extent that I'm, and I have an early case in the book, the Tanaka Memorial, where I'm relying on the official Russian history of foreign intelligence, published by Yevgeny Primakov, former head of SVR. And I'm quite confident that they simply get the story wrong based on their own archival materials. It's too complicated to go into what exactly they get wrong here. But my point is, can we trust? I'm trusting the CIA archives, even when they describe their disinformation operations or political warfare, as they called it in Berlin. Because you read the memos and it just, you can see, it just makes sense. And it's, in a way, these are honest memos. But when I read some of the Soviet memos later on in the 80s, you can tell that they are not telling their partners where the truth ends and where the forgeries begin. So you can literally see self-disinformation at work. And as a result, I think I'm not trusting their archives in the same way.
Yeah, that's fascinating, like everything else in the book. So they're both overconfident in the use of the tool and self-deceptive often at the same time.
Yeah, I would absolutely think so, yeah.
Yeah. So we've been this is going to be the last question. We've been focusing in this talk primarily about disinformation and active measures in the pre-digital era. And you're going to have another talk on Lawfare about events that occurred in what we'll call the digital era. But just as a bridge, how did the rise of digital communications impact active measures?
Yeah, let me say, when I wrote the book and I moved from the pre-internet age into the internet age, so from the 80s into the 90s, basically, and then the 2000s, I just found it extremely difficult to. I was, by that moment, I was used to having great sources. I was used to having archival sources, sometimes not always, the actual memos and proposals and evaluations. But of course, all that stops when the Cold War, at the end of the Cold War. And the nature of the evidence completely shifts. I now have to rely on digital forensics, on sometimes accounts that, basically on the output of the operations themselves, which of course is much more incomplete and imperfect. So I think writing this history made me far more cautious and more humble in terms of understanding what's happening today. The biggest problem that we all face is that we can only see the exhaust of these operations, and in almost no case do we have actual insights into the decision-making process and the formulation of objectives for these operations. So I think I would just want to stress this point at the end. We just have to be honest about the limitations here and not jump to conclusions way too quickly. That will not stand up, I think, in the long term.
That's admirable and a great place to end. Thomas, thank you so much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Ian Enright is our audio engineer, and our producer is Jen Pache Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.